You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Jim Goldston, the director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, and very pleased to be collaborating with our colleagues at Minority Rights Group and ESCRNet in presenting this panel discussion on the occasion of the release of a new report on the impacts of strategic litigation to vindicate indigenous peoples' land rights. Executive summary is in print and here. The online version is available, and the full print will be distributed very, very soon. And I should say, the Justice Initiative and Open Society is very pleased to be involved in this effort. The report on indigenous land rights litigation is part of a larger multi-year project that my colleague Erica Daly here has been shepherding ruthlessly and relentlessly and with great effect. It's a project that has a very immediate institutional interest because the Open Society Justice Initiative engages in litigation, much of which we like to think of as strategic anyway, in many parts of the world with many partners. And Open Society Foundations is one of the largest funders of litigation by many folks in the field of human rights around the world. So we have a perhaps understandable interest in exploring and interrogating what's the value of the litigation that we are engaging in or supporting and with what effect. But I think as well, we thought that there are broader interests at stake in addition to our own that animate these studies. One of which is that while there have been a number of studies in the academic sphere and in others that are aimed primarily at the litigator level, how to do effective litigation, which of course is critical, we thought it was important to look more broadly through the lens of the social change actor, someone who is seeking to effect change in a particular area, thematically, geographically, and asking, how do I do that, or how do I and my community members and allies do that, and what role does litigation, if any, play in conjunction with a range of other tools that people use to bring about change in the human rights field. And so we thought that we would try to make a contribution with this range of partners by rooting the research and the activity very much in the minds and in the hands and the emphases of actors in the field. So while this was guided, the studies have been guided by an extremely reputable group of advisors, the principal questions emerged, frankly, from the actual practical challenges that actors engaged in a range of human rights areas are in fact confronting so that this can be as useful as possible for them as a tool. And I guess finally as well, we felt that this is an important thing to do. Even though we started this a few years ago, we feel it's become even more important with the wave of nationalist populism that has taken over broad parts of the world, including right here, which has impacts on various kinds of political organization and the ability to air certain grievances. And in many ways, courts have become even more important as a space for people to raise concerns, as a space for people to trigger independent scrutiny and sometimes public condemnation of government action. So we feel that the question of what impacts litigation can have has grown only more urgent. Now, as I said, this is the study on indigenous peoples' land rights is one in a series. We're also looking at the situation of equal access to quality education in a number of countries. And we'll be coming out with a report later on as well on litigation to secure redress from custodial torture. And then we'll be kind of pulling these together to see what general lessons can be learned. But we didn't want to wait until it was all done before presenting the really interesting findings that are in this report on land rights here. Before going on, I'll just say one other thing, that the studies have been framed to look at three broad categories of impacts. So recognizing that there's no right way to define these, but loosely we've been thinking that one category is material impacts, compensation or other immediate benefits to the parties to litigation. Secondly, institutional changes, policy changes, jurisprudential changes that may result from litigation. And finally, discursive or attitudinal changes, changes in a public agenda, the symbolic role of litigation in affecting the way people think about, speak about, and ultimately act to bring about change. So with that as a preview, we're thrilled to have three superb panelists here to talk about these issues. First of all, to my far left is Rodrigo Villagra Carrón, who is the president of Tierra Viva a los Pueblos Indígenas del Chaco in Paraguay, the leading litigation and advocacy organization working on behalf of the rights of indigenous persons, who litigated the landmark Sacmoc Casek Indigenous Community versus Paraguay case that I think we'll be hearing a little bit more about before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. To my immediate left is Jeremy Gilbert of the University of East London, who's a professor of international and comparative law. Jeremy is the principal author of the study, did an extraordinary job, and we're thrilled to have him here as well, and is really one of the leading experts on the field of indigenous persons, indigenous land rights. And finally, to my right, Lucy Claridge, who directs litigation at Minority Rights Group, has been deeply involved in the litigation from Kenya involving the Enderoy community. We'll be hearing a bit about that, but is involved in a range of litigation touching on these issues. And gratefully for us, Lucy kindly served as an advisor to the project and this report. Our plan is to hear brief presentations from each of the colleagues in turn. I'll follow up with some questions, and then we'll open it up and very much welcome an interactive discussion with colleagues here in the audience. So with that, Jeremy, if I can ask you to begin, please.
Hello, everyone. Pleased to meet you. And for those of you that were already at the lunch earlier on, sorry to impose myself on you again. So I'm going to take 7 minutes to give you a summary of the main finding of the report. So basically, it won't be everything. So I really invite you to go to the report itself. It's not that long. So briefly, to place where this is coming from, it's even though we've been looking at three countries, namely Malaysia, Paraguay, and Kenya, we're aiming at talking at the global level. Litigation on land rights has really become global over the last 10 years. It's been present before, but over the last 10 years, there's no country in the world where indigenous peoples haven't started to go for litigation. So this is really much where the study is placing itself. The reason we choose those countries is to give ourselves a 5 years period to go back to the communities and see what happened after a case. So like all the studies, part of this project, it's called the 360. So it wasn't only about the communities, we went to the medias, politicians, judges, lawyers, to really get a sense of what is the impact. So what I'm going to take you very briefly are the main bites on impacts on the three that Jim has just mentioned. Before I do that, even though I'm on the podium, this is not a one-man show. My colleagues here, Kaninke from Kenya, Joel works on Paraguay, and Colin from Malaysia, taking picture, are very much also the authors with me. So we work very close together on this to make sure that what is on coming from the ground is represented in the is actually based on the facts. So what do we find was common is, as I said earlier on, the word strategic was a bit problematic when we started. Why? Because indigenous peoples, when they start to go to court, it's not strategic. It's just the last resort. It's just your land has been taken away. The government is telling you you don't have any right on that land. And basically, you've tried all the options. What's left to you is to go to court. And again, that's for the country where the rule of law is possible. So what we've learned is the word strategic is not problematic. That's why it's still on the title, because what all communities have said, it becomes strategic. It wasn't at the start, but then it becomes very strategic in the struggle for land rights. So litigation becomes one of the tools, the other tool that are there. What also has been important, it's to understand that despite all the community have been facing extreme challenge in terms of getting to courts. I guess many of you are litigators in this room. Land rights cases are very special in the sense they take even longer than any case you can imagine, because the burden of proof is immense. It's actually totally unfair. It's put on the indigenous people that live on the land to prove that they live on the land, and they've done so. That takes an immense, long, and painful process for communities. The cases we're talking about usually take 10 years to arrive to a decision. What also was common, the very poor implementation. You might win in the courts, but that's not the end of the road. But what communities have been clearly in the three countries saying, it's that despite the poor implementation, they're still glad they went through the process, and they still will do it, and they will still recommend to their colleagues to do the same. So why is that? So I'm going to take you through material impacts, because of course the main question is, do you get the land demarcation? Do you get the land restitution? I wish the answer was yes, but it's not like this. It's a bit more complex. It's not totally no, it's not totally yes. It's something between. What really is the learning point is litigation is rather the start than rather than the end. If, despite the 10 years that I just mentioned, you start litigation, you win a case, but actually you start the process of implementation. When I say really you start, it's the legal team, it's the communities that have to engage and push the government to really follow what the court have been saying. And that is part of the process, and that's been common for all the communities. So it's not that there's no land restitution, and some of my colleagues here will talk more about the details, and there's a lot of details in the report, so I invite you to look at that. But overall, there's been a bit of restitution, but not that much. There's been other material impacts in sense of economic benefits, recognition of the value of the lands, and etc. Now, in terms of the other factor we look at, it's legal and political. In terms of the political impact, the main thing is mainly institutional. We don't see massive change in the political apparatus of the states or the approach towards indigenous peoples, which I should say is massively discriminatory in all the countries. The change really comes from states in the three countries when they've been Victorian courts. They've actually established specific institutions with mandates, you can look at the detail, that are not so strong, but nonetheless institutions that are in charge to look at the implementation or process. Usually they call task force. It says a lot in the sense of the government is trying to think about what would be an eventual implementation. But nonetheless, we also see parallel involvement of institutions like National Human Rights Commission that were not so active, that because of the litigation get more interested and are more open to receive those claims. The impact on the legal system, I said usually, and that's quite common for indigenous peoples, they're in a bad situation when they start, where the legal system, the formal legal system, just say you don't have the right to the land, that simple. What the court decision are doing is to say, no, actually, there's space for other form of ownership of the land. That creates a space in the judicial system. So that's one of the important impact, is to challenge the often colonial legacy that was left on what is land possession, that it can't be collective, it can't be based on customary law. So there's an opening. I'm not saying it's perfect, but the courts are actually opening a gate there to challenge this dynamic. In terms of the third impact, which was about the behavior, which is actually the most challenging one, was to measure this. We divided the task on looking at the communities and the non-communities, so the media, politicians, etc. For the communities, it's been quite clear that the main word that came across was empowerment. I think the best summary I got from one of the quote from some of the victims was the right to have rights. It's basically this notion that you're not anymore a squatter on the land, you just actually have a right to the land. Whatever the implementation, it's just this process of recognizing this is a right-based approach to it. What was connected to this, many communities have been saying that it was a motivation factor in the struggle. Remember, I said litigation comes usually as a last resort when everything has been tried. But this litigation actually provided a new momentum in the struggle. It's provided motivation by the community, and Lucy will talk more about the cohesion, the participation of the community, but that was a very, very big, vivid, clear statement from all the communities across the three countries. There was also, it's not only positive, many communities, and especially in Paraguay, have been saying, you know, last resort, we go to court, we win, no implementation, that creates a lot of disillusion and disempowerment. If nothing happened, then the question is what next, once you've exhausted everything. So there was also this problem of lack of implementation, what is next, what will happen. And maybe to put it there straight away, one of the main findings and recommendations is actually on this. It's any lawyers, litigator engaging in this needs to realize winning in court is not the end, it's the start. The post-strategy litigation is very important to work with the communities even before the decision is made. In terms of the change in society, there was very little evidence of impact on challenge on the largely racist and discriminatory approach of the mainstream society towards indigenous communities. There was evidence that some of the local media picked up and started to acknowledge that there was indigenous communities in the local vicinity. But again, that wasn't really something that came strongly on challenge. It doesn't look like litigation actually challenged the mainstream vision of indigenous peoples. I'm getting there. The other maybe a bit negative impact of litigation was the increase of violence that could be created. The imbalance between the communities, the neighboring communities, but also the reaction of the government after winning a case. We've seen communities being targeted, leaders being targeted because of their engagement in the litigation. So to conclude, the three words that the study is putting forward, there have been three main effects. One is the unlocking. What I mean by unlocking is, as I said, the narrative of the state was you don't have any right on that land, it belongs to the government. That litigation has allowed to unlock a bit this dynamic and to challenge that. And it links to the second aspect, which is the reframing. Trying to reframe the narrative of dispossession of indigenous people being squatter to be seen as actually entitled to rights to the land. And the third important element is the participation. And I'm going to continue on this because my colleagues will touch on this, but really for communities, they've been clear that the whole process of going to court, working with the legal team, with the NGOs that are supporting, has been extremely important in the narrative of the community, building the case and getting a sense of community. An important aspect was the evidence of the lands. You know, how do you do the mapping? How do you prove who has the right to the lands, the participation of the woman, the younger, the older, in this process of proving the possession of the land. So on that note, I'm going to pass on to my colleagues. They will develop a bit more on those three aspects, and I'm happy in the question to develop much more on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's hard to summarize so succinctly, and you've done a fabulous job, a report of such comprehensiveness and depth. Lucy, I want to turn to you, but I'm tempted to ask, and you can touch on it now or we can touch on it later, but where Jeremy started actually is in some ways makes sense. In some ways it's counterintuitive. Yes, so he says that strategic litigation, the study found, in this field is not a construction. You know, lawyers, we go to these meetings and think about how are we going to put together the various elements, what's the kind of case we want to create. He says that's not how it's happened. It's happened because people are forced to a certain situation. They've tried everything else. Nothing works. Their backs are against the wall, and they have no choice but to go to court. That's how they do it. And the case over time acquires strategic aspects as they marry it with other tools and other forms of advocacy. I'm just curious, does that represent your experience in this work?
Thank you, Jim. So I'm speaking from my experience working on litigation for Indigenous peoples' rights in 8 years in Eastern Central Africa, but also MRG's experience more over the last 15 years. In terms of the strategic nature of MRG's involvement in the litigation, I think when we first became involved in the Enderose case, we could see that it actually was very strategic on an international level and on a regional level. And we looked first at the Inter-American system and all the precedents that had already been created there, recognizing indigenous people's rights. And we could see that this hadn't actually been reflected within African regional jurisprudence. And therefore, we felt that there was a need to take a case on behalf of the Enderoys to the African Commission and for the African Commission to establish the rights of indigenous peoples and recognize their rights over land, their right to culture, religion, their right to livelihood. And so for us, it was strategic. I think, though, the Enderoys would have a different perspective because they really were in a desperate situation. They had been evicted from their homes in the 1970s. They'd spent nearly, 35 years before they came to us. They'd been through national litigation. They'd been through national advocacy, and it hadn't led anywhere. So coming to us was a bit of a last resort. Luckily, it was successful in terms of establishing a strategic precedent, but there is still obviously a lot of work to do in terms of implementing that precedent.
If you want now to elaborate on any of the points that Jeremy, please go ahead.
Sure. So I was going to talk a little bit about what Jeremy touched on, the litigation for indigenous communities being very protracted, very onerous, very unpredictable. And those of you in the room who are lawyers or those of you who've been involved in litigation may think, well, why is that so different to other litigation? Why is that so different to other national, regional, international litigation? And I just wanted to offer a bit of perspective of the challenges that actually poses for indigenous communities. So first of all, indigenous communities will often be very large. The Enderoys, for example, number approximately 60,000. The Ogiek, another community we work with in Kenya, about 35,000. It's not just a case on behalf of one person or two people. It's that there is a real need to keep them involved in the litigation throughout this whole lengthy process. And that's a very difficult thing to do, actually. There's a need for constant outreach. There's a need for engagement with civil society representatives on the ground. And to make sure that they stay involved and understand the process throughout the whole of the litigation. And then through the post-litigation period, the implementation. Secondly, the events leading to the evictions may have happened years ago. There will be numerous violations, as I've already touched on. This isn't just about the right to property or natural resources. It's about people's livelihoods. They will be living often in very destitute circumstances, and they will be very open to divide and rule. And so certainly in the case of, again, the Enderoys, some people did come forward and give evidence on behalf of the government. So again, there is this need to engage with this whole vast community, these vast communities, and ensure that they understand the process and to keep them behind, to keep them together, to keep them united. Thirdly, another effect of the evictions is that a community who have physically often been together will actually have been scattered across a very wide area. Again, so there's a need for a lawyer or a team of lawyers working on a case to actually go out and visit them and to regularly do that, to keep them together. And you need to take evidence from whole swathes of different people in the community, so from women, from the elders, from youth, because the evictions will have had a completely different effect on women, for example, in comparison to the effect that will have taken place for men. And then I think also Jeremy also touched on this need to have a very long-term strategy. Unfortunately, even when successful before the courts, governments, for various reasons, whether it's lack of political will, whether it's respecting the interests of investors, they don't wish to implement these judgments. So really, before you start the litigation and throughout the litigation, you need to be thinking, how are we going to implement this? And you need to be conducting national advocacy, engaging with local human rights ombudsmen, for example. In Kenya, we particularly involved the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. And so litigation is just a tool, but there need to be a whole raft of other methods that go alongside the litigation and complement it. And lastly, Jeremy also touched on the harassment that can happen for lands rights offenders. This is happening, unfortunately, more and more, and particularly in Latin America. It's been very high profile recently. So organizations can, we have successfully used paralegal training to empower communities so that they understand what their rights are, and so that they can go and represent victims who are perhaps silenced through criminal action. So because lawyers may be far away and they live very remotely, this is another way of empowering and bringing together unity. So in conclusion, I think the two points I will raise are that, yeah, there is a huge need for unity. There is a big need for a long-term strategy, but this has big implications in terms of the resources, the amount of investment, and also the level of engagement for strategic litigation for Indigenous peoples. Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy. So I'm provoked by so many comments. I'm thinking where to go here. First of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that there is not. At least in the terms in which this report uses the term, I think there's not a self-identified member of an Indigenous community on this panel, although there are some in the room, and there were a number certainly at the meeting we held today at the United Nations. But obviously those voices are critical to this dialogue, and I guess actually that does move me to ask, in light of the observation, Lucy, you just said, that the importance of lawyers visiting communities, having maintaining very close contact, to use the term important to keep them together, keep them united. Whose agency are we talking about here? Who decides? Jeremy, in your experience, let me just ask you on this. So what did you find? I mean, who's deciding on these cases? Who's deciding whether to pull the trigger and go to court, and what decisions are made about the way that is done in these cases? Did the lawyers do that? Did the communities do that? Did somebody else do that?
I'm going to go outside the report, actually, and just on the case I know that I worked on, which is in Uganda. So the Batwa are very marginalized in Uganda. They live on the volcano between Rwanda and Uganda. They've been chased from the park. It took them 10 years to decide to go to court. But they did. NGOs were clear, we're going to take the time. Despite being really pushed, that's why I said they are extremely marginalized. The racism is huge. People are telling me, but Jeremy, they're not human. Why do you work with them? It's that kind of racism you're facing. Despite this, they didn't want to attack the government in their own words. So the NGOs plus the communities that they created their own NGOs realized that there was no way out, that they had to go to court. They went back to all the communities because the same situation here, it's a bit smaller. We're talking only about 6,000 people, but they live in a very scattered areas. All the leaders took the time to go back to explain what is litigation, what it means. It took 3 years. But it came clear that the 6,664 people wanted to go to court. I was a bit blown away, you know, arriving there, like, oh, wow, 3 years. But then I'm so glad because no, whatever happened in the court, they are so strong. And again, it's not the whole committee can stay united all the time. There's a lot of, you know, money, there's a lot of money involved in those lands. But because the decision was a collective will from the start, it's harder to break. So my answer, it takes time, but many communities said, so what? We've been there for so long. We've been oppressed for so long. What is 2 years in that time? So I think it's for lawyers and NGOs to understand this process that, in a way, we're just witnessing. We're just there to support when we've been asked on what is self-determination really means in this context. But that's pretty much it. The rest is the community actually doing that. They could have decided we'd not go to court, and that's. So I don't know. I can only talk. This is the only case where I've been really involved for a long term. But I guess Lucy and also you can talk about this, but every single case basically takes a lot of time, but it's important to give that time.
Great, thank you. No, we will definitely come back. We can return to this theme. I do want to get Rodrigo into the discussion. Rodrigo, you've been one of the leading litigators in Paraguay, a country which, if I'm not mistaken, has seen more litigation before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the Inter-American system more generally on these issues than any other country in the Americas.
Yeah, that's
right. What's the experience that you've had there?
Well, actually, talking about China, I want to talk the time before litigation as well a little bit. So exactly, but I have like 5 cases, and 2 of them were like friendly agreements. So 3 of them are actually cases taken before the court. But I don't know whether to consider we were talking when strategic litigation start. From our point of view, at some point, we were trying to do at national level strategic litigation. You know, once there was a coup d'etat against the dictator, there was a guy who founded Tierra Viva and supported 13 communities and say, well, now we had to go bold and we had to go public and we had to be very political, not doing the kind of support that other NGOs were doing, like just, you know, taking the cases before the state agencies, not doing like much support, much noise on the press, and not confronting especially the landowners who had sites, the land of the indigenous people. So the strategy was there. When we go in bold now, we're going in public, we're going to show how evil are these landowners. They were evil, but they were, you know, doing the whole span of their evilness. Like, and that one had backlash that actually in the 90s, some cases, actually some landowners just gave out and say when there was some money in the government because there was another fight, it's just to get the money to compensate the landowners, that they have to be compensated. And, well, some of them just gave up and say, well, I sell my land. And that was one of the friendly agreements. But the others just became harder and say, you know, these are poor, they don't work. And many of the landowners were like politicians themselves. So when it comes a time when we have to take to expropriation law, then the momentum was higher and then they were harder. And actually then when we go the backlash and this happened, what we say, what now? And the people say, what now? You know, we have lose the expropriation. What is left? We lose in the national era, and there's nothing else that we can do. You know, it's the parliament. We have sometimes like some alliance in the executive, but the parliament says no. And from the beginning of the 20th century, like 21st century, there haven't been any kind of law related to indigenous people that has passed through the parliament. So it was really blocked. And actually, it was kind of, we say, ideological and kind of conspiracy. And so there's 3 cases, like, were blocked in the parliament, and that's when we decide to go to the Inter-American Court. And then it's how Jeremiah described, like, people had to, we in the process, like, say, I began as a law student in Tierra Viva and ended up like as an anthropologist doctor, you know, because actually we needed to find out the arguments and really stronger and better and wiser, like arguments about like the economic other like related rights to land, and to show like that people die while we're expecting to get back their land. People have no education, have no health, salary, they have no opportunities. They couldn't go even hunting because the confrontation with the landowner was bigger. So that's why it was a second momentum, and then we got the sentences. And then, yeah, that's the kind of the 3 sentences where, like, the last one was in 2010. And from then, we began with the implementation, which is another stage. And then we had to reframe the whole strategy because, you know, at that time, before we expected, now we got the sentencing, you know, like the implementation should follow like automatically, which it didn't happen at all. And we say, when we now have, you know, the Inter-American Court, the organization of American states, like, you know, backing us, but actually you have to see the same faces of the same, you know, politicians or actors in a local level that they have to actually deliver. So you have to also develop and create a state that actually is prepared to oblige to what the court has said. So that was kind of that experience.
Thank you very much. Lucy, is this a field, and is this a field that's learning? Are we learning from the experience? Is this report is produced on the assumption that there is some kind of coherent discussion, and that groups, legal, non-legal, community, non-community, in one place maybe learning from the experiences of others? Is that the experience you're finding at MRG? Is that happening?
Thank you. Is this a field? Yes, I think I would say it is. We have a number of different communities who contact us asking for assistance, whether it's regional litigation or regional advocacy, international advocacy, but also national advocacy as well, national litigation. Indigenous people's land rights and other rights, and there are other rights that flow from them, are not respected throughout the whole of the world. And litigation has developed, I think it started to develop particularly in the inter-American system, but also in Latin American courts as well, Latin American litigation. But it has developed as a tool that indigenous peoples can use to try and seek their rights, to gain recognition, to get restitution of their land, to have their cultural rights respected, to gain identity. So simple answer, yes, I would say it is.
Please, Jeremy, yes.
Just maybe as an example, you know, I'm looking at, we picked Malaysia, Paraguay, and what I was struck by is, you know, the commonality between the struggles, but also the learning experience from each other. Indigenous communities share a lot, and they can learn, you know, the sharing is amazing because they face exactly the same problem with cases. Building those evidence, you know, it's really hard for a community to accept that an expert will talk on their behalf in front of the court. Why is this expert sitting up there? Why is the anthropologist up there? You know, I'm not... they can, but, you know, it's... So from this, there's a lot to learn. And also, we shouldn't forget, law is very colonial in its language, especially when it comes to property rights. It's individual property title. It's a massive challenge for a community which there's no concept as such. It's a customary collective. It's not even ownership. They're told about they are custodian of the land. So that creates a massive learning experience between communities on how do you challenge, which in the end, even if it's civil or common law, it's very common. They're actually based on the same basis, which is either you have individual property title to the land, mainly you're wealthy enough to have this and done the formal process, or it belongs to me in the government. For these peoples, it's all the same. It belongs to the government, they don't exist. So for them, learning that even in Malaysia or Paraguay under Kenya, that's derived to the same thing, the same problem. It's actually a massive learning experience across the board. And that could be applied to any country, you know, even this country. So that in that sense, yeah, it's a field, but also a field that there's a massive comparative element. And I think when I talk about globalization of litigation, this is what has happened in the last 10 years. It used to be only the same actors, Canada, US, New Zealand, Australia. That's totally changed. Why? Because Malaysia started with cases that were brought from Canada, from Australia, and that's unpacked all this dynamic of colonization. So in that sense, yeah, there's a, it's more than a field. It's moved very quickly. One victory in one corner of the world will create a movement somewhere on the Amazon when it's taking place in the Arctic.
No, just want to say about like the question is on whose agency it is that we're talking about. Like actually, our experience is like at some point when the people the first job what they have is like to tell people that actually there were laws after the coup d'état, the transition to democracy, that they have laws that they support them to have the claims before the state, because before there was a policy that agencies would just with give money and the money will be used to buy land that was offered for anyone, but not talking about ancestral land and not whatsoever. So, and then the communities kind of become, and the leaders become to be more public, and they just pick up from that. And then as well, there were some points where the landowner didn't want to give their land or sell the land. And even sometimes we suggested them, why you don't occupy the land? You know, this is different your situation to the peasants who have no right to be in their land that is not their ancestral land. You know, they have to be another process. For indigenous people, they have the right to be in the land. It's not illegal in any point. But people at some point would say no. Oh, they wouldn't say anything, but say, well, we're going to do it. But they actually were expecting. And that's what happened when they saw that the landowners were kind of defeated legally. They say, well, that's the time, you know. And now we are going to resist till the end. And even if the police come here, and that happened in Sawayamaxa and in other cases. So actually, and also as well, like there is a process, a hard process to get consensus. And I think like strategic litigation have two legs, you know, have the lawyers and the team that have to be, of course, they have many complicated things. It's a long time, a lot of money, a lot of training, and I don't know, many things. At the same time, the community, they have their own conflicts. Sometimes, you know, some leaders just want to compromise with the government and say, well, let's go for 3,000 hectares, then 14,000 hectares. And they will actually want to make like a deal under the table sometimes, and it also happen. And then the state would do that, use against their own litigation case. Yeah, you know, why you want to keep that? See, the leader said already they wanted just 300,000. You are the one, you know, to keeping this problem not to be solved. So this all kind of problem happens, and in 10 years, in 20 years, they just get bigger and repeated. But in the end, are the communities that with their resilience, you know, and their capacity, you know, to struggle, like actually also help, you know, the lawyers and mutually or the other team actually become a bigger team actually to hold the cases.
I want to invite people to come in, but so please think of comments or questions you may want to have and raise. Before doing that, I just want to raise one further question for you guys. For better or worse, a fair amount of the litigation in this field to date has been donor-supported. I want you to correct me on that if that's incorrect. But let's assume that that you're talking with a donor about who is interested in furthering the land rights of indigenous peoples. And the donor says to you, look, I've read your report. It's a great report, Jeremy. And I get your point that you can't pursue you can't pursue litigation in isolated fashion. You have to marry it to a range of other tools. I understand that. But I'm just one donor, and I only have a certain amount of money. And I want impact, and I want to show, you know, the relationship between what I give and the results that are produced. So I can only focus on one of those tools. Other people are going to do other things. I get it. But I want you to tell me, if I had to choose between putting all my money into litigation or into advocacy before the UN or a social media campaign or empowerment at the community level, what should I choose? Which one tool is more important than another? What would you say to that donor?
I think Lucy is more equipped than me to answer to this, but because this is what you do on a daily basis. This is the challenge of litigation, because you know the 10 years is, you basically have to convince all those donors that on the way they will get something on their specific project. So you create specific narrow projects that are part of the long strategy. Yeah. Okay, this is the job of the NGOs, these two guys, of having this long-term perspective where you say, I need a bit of money for the paralegals, a bit of money to support a meeting of the community in one place to actually talk about this. I need the money to have the anthropologist expert, the lawyers come in. So the donors are convinced they do really well because they have one project where the name will be attached to it, they will get what they want. But it's the community and their supportive team that actually have the long-term vision. Because I wish we could find one donor that would do the 10 years job, but doesn't exist, and I don't think it will ever exist. So basically, it's to convince them, if you want to do UN stuff, yeah, fine, but the lawyer is actually going to use that as a way to put pressure on the case by getting the UN to actually support the case at the national level. So it's the creativity of, I would say these two, but all the people I've met that are doing this long term of work.
Lucy, anything you want to tell that donor?
I want to say that Jeremy just summed that up very well, and maybe okay. He should come and do some fundraising. I think we've been working with the NGOs, for example, for 15 years, and it is very hard to find someone who doesn't get a result, find a donor that if there isn't a result in 3 years and you can't show some kind of impact, that they still want to continue funding. And I think also the nature of particularly this litigation, because it is so unpredictable. And you can have a developer 3-year plan with various activities, and then for various reasons the activities will be delayed because the land rights defender is harassed, or and you can't carry out the advocacy you're expecting. So I think really there's a need for donors to be incredibly flexible, and to really see what the outcome is at the end, what you're trying to achieve, and that this is a holistic process. It's litigation, but it's legal empowerment, and it's national, regional, international advocacy. There is no one-size-fits-all answer, but it has to be developed, and it has to be developed in conjunction with the community as well.
Well, actually, it's important, I think, because it is true, actually, you need, like, the money all along the process. And there is one thing that you can get money back, you know, when you litigate. Like, the court has said that Tierra Viva, as a litigator, should get some money back for the cost of litigation. But there is one thing, there is something that, depending how you use the money, people would say, and we have 3 cases, like, ah, no, you're doing this for money. And then certain communities wouldn't understand, like, why actually you already pay. Or your organization have, like, donors, why they would use the money. And then the government would say, ah, right, you get the money from the government. Yeah, yeah, so you are part of the government. Anyway, you get the money from the government. So it's like you have to be really keeping that out of the line. And that's why also throughout your history, litigating, have to say to certain donors, yes, I want to get your money, and to others, like, no, because that you can be, you know, related to the government, or to, like, even some landowners or something like that. So that's an issue as well.
Very good. Thank you very much. So, colleagues, there's a lot of rich expertise and experience in this room. So, Eric, do folks need to go to the microphone in order to be heard? Right. So we're recording this. So if I can ask you, we'll start with 3. So let's go with this gentleman I saw first, the lady in black right here with the black shirt, and that person over there. Yes, you, please. If you could just go up to the microphone, give us your name and any affiliation briefly, and then please pose your comment or question briefly. Thank you.
Bruce Rosen, citizen of planet Earth. I would appreciate if you would tie this to the environmental calamity the planet is facing. And I know that a lot of the issues of land are over the environment, both environmental justice and economic justice and stewardship. So could you say something about that, and also a bit more of when indigenous groups begin to cooperate? Where does legal assistance fit in that realm?
Thank you. Let's take the 3 questions. Please go ahead.
My name is Pauline Vata from Haki Jamii Nairobi, and my question is basically to all the panelists. What is the impact of litigation to government? Do you think litigating reduces cases of evictions to indigenous people, or do you get one successful case that the indigenous people learn from each other, then they also go to court, and then the government needs to stop, or does the government also listen and does not evict? I hope you got.
Great. Thank you very much. Please.
Hi, my name is Meredith Ogilvie-Thompson. I'm a director of International Senior Lawyers Project, but I also have a strategic advisory in Nigeria. So we've been working in Cross River. I'm just curious, when you talk about the challenges around fundraising for such a long-term project that has so many different moving parts, you said something at the beginning about once you win, the struggle can often begin then. It's enforcement of the judgment. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about what team comes in then and how you think about it differently strategically, and the challenges around funding then when donors turn to you and say, well, we paid for all this and here's what happened, and now you're telling us that that's not the end of the case. So thank you.
Super. Thank you very much. So what's the link between what we're talking about and issues of the environmental justice? What impacts on government, following up on Jeremy's observations, what do you do once you win a case? Who takes over? What do you do with the donor problem and the other problems we've been addressing? Should we start? Maybe Rodrigo, do you want to start? Just take any of those and go, and then we'll go right
Yeah, just wanted to refer to climate change. Actually, like, you know, when I started, we didn't speak much of the climate change. But you see now the rate of deforestation in the Chaco is the highest in the world, or the second or third. I got someone who's saying, well, in some places in the world is worse, you know, wow. So what, you know, what consolation you get from that? Yeah, but if you see in Paraguay, it's 1 million hectares out of 40 are in hands of the indigenous people. The cases before the Inter-American Court and the Inter-American Commission have restituted like 60,000 hectares, 6%. So you can see the result there, because like there is no deforestation on the level that is for like cattle raising or soya producers, and there's a direct impact. You know, even isn't like thought like that, and you can see, and many agencies like environmental agencies are yet looking now with indigenous people in Paraguay, saying, okay, now the indigenous people actually are taking care of the forest.
Jeremy, do you want
to? To make it easy, I'm going to kick back to you, which is basically your question answers your point, if that makes sense. Where it started is actually exactly that. It's finally, if your right to the land has been recognized, what we should recognize, it's not only the land we talk about, it's the resources and the way they are used. This is really what is at stake. And again, looking at the map of the world, why are those cases taking place on those? And there are the few last natural resources left on the planet that are so important. If you go to Kenya, they're actually sitting on the place that is driving the water crisis at the moment in Kenya. The same everywhere. So what I'm saying, it's the end. So you win in court, but then the question of the use of resources, this is where it starts. This is where sustainability, stewardship, which is the important one to use. This is really what is at stake. There's been a bit of a firewall, let's say, between the environmentalists and the human rights movements, where it hasn't really yet been included into the cases. So you win the case to the land, you have your human rights recognized, but actually the next step, which is sustainable development, use of resources on indigenous terms, which is the important aspect of the human rights law. Whereas environmental law has been pushing for more of those aspects, but very much we tell you to protect the land. So we are at sort of a junction, and that's where litigation will become even more interesting. There's only, as far as I know, I think there's only one case in Suriname that has done crossed the line, that has says environmental and human rights law actually work together. Why it goes to the funder? Where is the money at the moment for funding? You know, if you are climate change and Red Plus, you all heard about Red Plus, you're in better shape to get a bit of money. It might change. I know where you're going, and we're in the right place. There's a tower not far from here which is trying to stop this. But nonetheless, we are at this momentum where if you can use this money going into sustainable development, sustainable goals, stewardship, etc., and move to the human rights, it's maybe you can challenge me, but I don't think it's yet totally clear that you could use both and it's going the same way, which is indigenous people are saying exactly that. We've been on those lands. There's never been the problem we're facing, because before you arrived, it was fine. So that's why I'm saying when the case is won, this is actually discussion should start on this. But happy to defer to you.
Thank you. Lucy.
So Jeremy has said there is just one case that has touched on this link between environmental justice and indigenous people's rights. There is also another case that's currently pending before the African Court on Human and People's Rights, which is looking exactly at this. So there's an Ogiek representative in the room who can tell this story better than me, but the Ogiek are a community who have lived in the Mau Forest in Kenya for hundreds of years, and they have been evicted. Ostensibly for conservation, yet at the same time, there is a lot of logging happening in the Mau Forest. So what we have been asking the African Court to do is to actually look at the role that the Ogiek as hunter-gatherers, as indigenous peoples, should be playing within the conservation of the Mau Forest, so that if their land is restituted back to them, that they are actually the best people to protect and conserve the Mau Forest. And therefore, there shouldn't really be any harm in implementing it, if we are successful, implementing a successful judgment. So we're hoping that that judgment should be issued by the court within the next few months. So watch this space, basically.
Excellent. We're with bated breath. further comment? One there, here, somebody there, and Pam. Yeah, if you guys could just go to the mic, please. Thank you.
I'm Daniel Kube from Kenya, from the Ogier community. My question is about the waiting and the wanting, because it happens that it is always a big issue. I don't know how Jeremy managed to, because telling the community to wait because the case is being pushed and pushed is a big, big, big challenge. And again, keeping the community together to continue believing in what you are fighting for is another challenge. Another thing is an issue of when you say the agency, it is the community members who push for the cases, and then they now get what they want. But there come a case whereby they now ask, we have been waiting for the case, what am I going to eat? Now, the issue of annexures of things to be put together to be able to contain the people is something I will wish you to comment on, because you are not able to, because they say this issue of waiting, there is no food in the table and something like that. But it's only few partners or donors who are able to understand that you cannot tell us only to keep on doing advocacy, but sometimes you can also do capacity building or livelihood projects to keep the community. Maybe you can.
Just to clarify then, is the question for whom? For the lawyer, how do you keep the community together? For a donor?
As the leaders of the community. No, that the lawyer comes only to assist in litigation. But for us, the people from the community, how are you able to keep the people waiting for 10 years,
okay,
waiting for this number of years to continue waiting for the case for the judge?
Great.
Or something like that?
Thank you. Yes.
This is a good follow-up to that question. I'm Pamela Yates, the director of the documentary film 500 Years. I'm wondering what you do when indigenous defenders of the land are criminalized during the process of strategic litigation, and even worse than that, when violence or assassination happens to them. How do you move forward with the litigation?
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Andrew Songa from the Kenya Human Rights Commission, but the non-governmental organization as opposed to the state one. Just about 3 to 4 quick comments that I hope the panel can respond to. With regards to the conversation of whether litigation is strategic and how Jeremy described it at the beginning, I think one of the things from the Kenyan experience to look at and take acknowledgement of is, I think with any case, its strategic nature is inherent in how it has the ability or potential to tap into the environmental context within which it operates and how it can harness the opportunities presented to advance the promotion and protection of rights. So like in the Enderoes case, for example, one of the things that I think stood out also was how a claim on land rights became a doorstep to also almost litigate and reaffirm recognition of the community itself. We started in a situation where there was a question as to whether the Enderoes as a tribe does in fact exist or whether it was a sub-clan of another bigger tribe, to now discussing implementation with the Enderoes being in existence as a matter of fact. So you then find in the context and how you're able to harness the opportunities within that context, you then find a strategic nature coming through an evolving process. So I think that's always inherent in every case, and it's how you tap into that potential. But then also with regards to the other issue around, I think, the notion of development that was raised in the context of some of the comments, I think another thing that's emerging that we need to look at is the notion of ownership being minimized in the face of now trying to create compromises or encouraging increased dividends within the status quo. So by that I mean where states are increasingly being challenged by the notion of ownership of lands by indigenous peoples, they now find it maybe a bit more comfortable to negotiate within the current status quo concepts of developmental agendas. So that the phrasing like within our governments for now usually is to try and treat communities like the Ogiek by saying what you're not really looking for is ownership. What you're looking for is a better access to a developmental agenda that the state can provide. But don't rattle the status quo. Let's leave the lands designated as public, that we can have access to as a government. What we will do is facilitate better access to economic and social services for you. So then minimizing the very notion of ownership that communities are trying to drive on. And that finally, on the issue of this being a field, I think what has emerged from this study and from the experiences is that we need more analysis and appreciation of the impact, but within a transformative paradigm, which also attaches to the question of the donors, so that we should be having this conversation with a longer arc in mind. The study focused on immediately 5 years after a decision. I don't think that's a sufficient paradigm. But what does that then mean in terms of investment? It means that you need institutions that look at this also from a strategic point of view at the institutional level. So how far are you willing to invest in terms of furthering the notion of strategic litigation with these communities? And just outside the indigenous people's conversation, I'll give an example of the Kenya Human Rights Commission. We invested in a case or a cause for war veterans from our colonial freedom fighter period, the Mau Mau case. And actually, it transcended whatever negotiations and conversations we had with donors. It was literally something that was inherent from the formation of the institution. So it was actually a 20-year journey that really was about how invested the institution was in that process, regardless of whether we had donors at a certain given point in time, but the fact that we would make it work around that. So all our negotiations in terms of our strategic planning would always have the notion of that cause of those people in that case within the very heart of the institution. So that meant making tough choices, tapping into strategic reserves of the organization to sustain the cases at a time when donors weren't exactly supporting those cases. But then 20 years later, you then have the dividend of a compromise with the British government and the decisions coming in. But that only succeeded because the institution saw it as a strategic value for the institution and not just within an ordinary cycle of programming.
Thank you, Andrew. Those are fantastic comments. And the Mau Mau case is certainly one worth studying and learning from. So challenges of keeping communities together and dealing with the immediate difficulties that they face and sustaining them through the litigation, the challenges of criminalization of indigenous defenders and the complex concepts of what it means for litigation to be strategic, and what ownership means. Lucy, you want to start at this end this time?
Sure. So in relation to the challenges of a community that wants something on the table, and how those who are working on the ground, like Daniel, and how to keep that community together. I know this is, you have faced personally a lot of challenges in this respect. I think you're right that I think maybe actually human rights organizations who litigate need to think about partnering with those, with donors or with other organizations who can provide just a little bit more, who can provide sustainability to support the litigation, who can support livelihood projects, microfinance projects, these kinds of things. And so that's I think it's a very, very helpful comment. In relation to indigenous defenders who are criminalized, this has happened a couple of times in the cases that I've worked on. And how do we move forward? I don't think that there's necessarily a standard answer. I think it really depends on the circumstances. So, for example, one female indigenous community representative was facing a lot of harassment, and we nominated her but her organization nominated her for a Human Rights Defender Award. And in the hope that might improve her situation, and actually it led to even more harassment. So then we had to think very carefully about, you know, do we go and raise this at the UN? And actually she was in such a difficult situation that we decided we didn't raise it at the UN. We didn't take it any further, and we let her deal with it in her own way. So I think it really does depend on the situation, and it also really depends on what that person wants. You know, I think MRG is ready to help, but really wants to help and not make situations any worse than they already are.
Not much to add. I mean, Daniel, yeah, I know your situation. I can only talk maybe to pick up on Lucy. Going back to the cases I know more, where I saw some creative way around the waiting game, you know, cause it's a long time. But as I said, going back to the point that there's money on those lands, In Namibia, the SANA are also starting a process of really long litigation, claiming Etosha, which is, you know, the jewel of Namibia. What they started to do is, on the margin, another NGO, not Human Rights at All, started to create parallel tourism, which creates a lot of opportunities for the community. It's totally illegal under the government views. But that's fine, because tourists come, they bring money. That has supported the community efforts massively. The Batu have tried the same in Uganda. They created the trail, you know, for the famous Gorilla actually to take them. As a repression, the government, because they took the case, they actually dismantled the trail. So I'm not saying it always worked, but it created opportunities for the communities to actually provide support and, you know, have, as you said, food on the table. Because you can't wait 10 years. And also knowing that even if you win, the food is not going to arrive on the table. So tourism is one. Also, what the Batwa started was to create their own, I hate the term, but, MRIP, the experts mechanism, has commanded a study on business enterprise, indigenous business enterprise. Not the best way to frame it, but they're looking at this, like small scale way of for communities to have this regeneration. So the fact that MRIP is started to look at this, maybe touch on this, that finally human rights NGOs are starting to realize, hang on a minute, it's not only about the long-term strategy of the litigation. Communalization of, again, that's why when I started, I put the rule of law, you know, which was country where we could actually talk about the law. I'm not saying that there's no criminalization in Kenya or other places, but at least there's a process. In Malaysia, what an interesting case that Colin raised was six people were charged with trespass on the land. What the lawyers did, they actually reversed the charge, saying they're not trespassing, this is their land. And the court was a bit puzzled. Okay, hang on, this is not about that, this is about trespassing, this is a criminal act. But no, this is our land. And this actually started, correct me if I'm wrong, Colin, but this is reversing the charge of criminal offense to actually saying, you can charge us, but actually this is our land, and pushing on this. Now, that's fine, and again, it's a country where the rule of law is there. The other country where I work, where that's absolutely impossible, the Central African Republic, what we did, we had to evacuate people, because they just basically got killed. It was so dangerous to be a land rights defender that you basically were on the target list. So what do you do? The human rights NGO becomes something totally different, which is evacuation plan. Unfortunately, there's no other, I don't see any alternative, because then the rule of law is absolutely pointless. And, you know, and that's the worst situation I've seen, where people have been shifted to Cameroon, basically waiting for the conflict to end, and it's not happening.
Rodrigo.
Yeah, and regarding to livelihood, what actually with what we did and the communities agree and wanted is like to press the state to give some opportunities and to give assistance to the community like with food and clean water and health services. And that was one of the fights with the government, like just to, because they are obliged to do so by the sentences and even before some certain measures that they take the court and the commission. And but there is a big issue, you know, because the people sometimes want to leave, want to go somewhere because they want to find jobs and they can't just do it when they, in some cases, they live by the road. And sometimes they had to go hiding into hunting and gathering in the land, in their own land. So it's complicated, and that leads also to criminalization as well. And many leaders have been accused of several things. They've been harassed. And what find useful for that is just to make the cases the more public possible, you know, and to denounce, and for that, like the campaigning and international campaigning, so international, like Amnesty and others, helped a lot just to make those cases known. So that was actually kind of a warranty that it would worsen the results, or there would be like a sentence against those leaders, or even to members of Tierra Viva who've been like persecuted by the Supreme Court as well. Julia Cabello, my colleague, she was supposed to come here. She was being persecuted by the Supreme Court because she actually criticized something that the Supreme Court of Paraguay did. So, and criminalization is all the time. And now when the people are in the land as well, because there's people wanting to do logging, you know, and it's under the law, and the landowners in some cases say, well, this is still my land, and the people are stealing the forest, the wood from my land. So there are all kind of complications, but I think we need the friend of human rights. Like you, what we do is just to make those cases bold and try to be the best and make the public. And related to context, I will say that actually context-wise, like in all the cases require to be, to be very flexible and to invite the donors and anyone who wants to support the cases that they are going to support a long road, you know. And when you have actually now the process of implementation, the process that we are going to talk about, for instance, like the development project about with the money that the government is going to be at the communities, that we had to learn, all of us, the community, the lawyers, and all the people, to see how to implement that.
Thank you so much. Colleagues, I think we're going to have to bring this to a close. But as it won't surprise you, this is not the last discussion of this. I mentioned that for Open Society's part, we are halfway through a multi-report process that will be yielding further discussions and further insights. And we very much look forward to working with you as we better understand how to do this all better. I want to thank the panelists who've been just superb. I want to thank you. I want to thank our colleagues at ESCRNet and at Minority Rights Group, and look forward to talking with you further. Thank you very much.